Poplar Island was once a thriving community in the Maryland portion of Chesapeake Bay. Since a survey measured the island at over 1,110 acres in 1847, the combined forces of erosion, sea level rise, and subsidence reduced the area to small islets totaling only 4 acres by 1990. Federal and state partners from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Maryland Department of Transportation, Maryland Port Administration, have jointly sponsored a project to restore this lost, remote island habitat. Officially called the Paul S. Sarbanes Ecosystem Restoration Project at Poplar Island, the project relies on beneficial use of dredged material collected from the approach channels to Baltimore Harbor. Upon completion, the project will result in 1,715 acres of developed wetland, upland, and open water embayment habitats. Welcome. You're listening to Coastal Conversations, the National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science podcast. I'm Kevin McMahon. The Chesapeake Bay is the largest estuary in the United States and is a complex ecosystem that encompasses a wide range of habitats that support more than 3,600 species of plants, fish, and other animals. The bay is also a very productive habitat, producing over 500 million pounds of harvested seafood each year. Some bay habitats, particularly shorelines and submerged aquatic vegetation, are in critical need of restoration. At Poplar Island, 5 different habitat types are being created. Not only will these habitats support a diverse assemblage of plants and animals, but some of the habitat types to be created include those that are most sorely needed in the bay, including upland habitats, high and low salt marshes, tidal flats, and seagrass beds. Fish and other wetland organisms play a key economic and cultural role in Chesapeake Bay. Understanding animal habitat preferences and their movements in a variety of habitats is essential to responsibly manage coastal ecosystems and sustain healthy populations. This understanding is especially critical in habitat restoration projects, pre-construction and post-construction, so as to inform future design of engineered marshes and wetlands. Beginning in spring 2023, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science has been tracking fish movements throughout the marshes and embayments on Poplar Island to determine how fish are utilizing the restored habitats. NCOS researchers are tagging dozens of fish and aquatic species with coded transmitters and are releasing them back into the wild. An array of hydroacoustic receivers deployed around the marsh act as automated data loggers and will be tracking the tagged species movements and locations over the next 2 years. In this episode, we'll be hearing from lead NCOS scientist, Dr. Matt Kendall, as he takes time out from his work at Poplar Island to tell us a little more about the project. Here's Matt giving us an overview of the history of the Poplar Islands in the Middle Chesapeake Bay.
A little bit about the history of Poplar Island. So, of course, Europeans had settled in and around the Chesapeake Bay since the 1600s. The best record we have of how big Poplar Island was comes from around 1847, when a survey suggested that the land area of Poplar was around 1,100 acres. And just for reference, a football field is about 1.3 acres, so you add up, you know, over 1,000 of those, and that's how big Poplar Island was. By the late 1800s, there were maybe 100 residents. The place had a, small town almost, if you will, but it had a post office and that sort of thing. Over the next couple decades, however, residents began leaving as more and more landmass was lost. Why was the landmass lost? A combination of things. Subsidence, where basically the land is sort of sinking or compressing and getting lower, and sea level rise, which is just what it sounds like. In fact, sea level has risen in the Chesapeake Bay area about 1 foot in the last century. Relative sea level rise in the Chesapeake Bay is about twice as fast compared to the global average. So the combination of subsidence and rising sea level means you're going to get a lot of erosion because Poplar and a lot of islands in Chesapeake Bay are very low-lying. So more and more of the land mass is lost. And by the 1990s, there was only about 4 acres of kind of disconnected island remnants and nobody lived there. In fact, the place had been essentially vacant with no permanent residents since the 1940s. At which time it was basically just a little hunting camp. So that sort of sets the stage for, you know, you've got these little 4 acres left, and the idea with the restoration project is to restore all of that habitat to what it once was, and even more, to 1,700 acres is the ultimate goal.
As we've learned, the island was once made up of one solid landmass. But that began to break into smaller islands from the effects of wind-driven erosion, sea level rise, and a complicated process known as subsidence. The last ice age occurred just 16,000 years ago, when great sheets of ice, 2 miles thick, covered much of Earth's northern hemisphere. Though the ice melted long ago, the land once under and around the ice is still rising and falling in reaction to its ice age burden. This ongoing movement of land is called glacial isostatic adjustment. Here's how it works. Imagine lying down on a soft mattress and then getting up from the same spot. You see an indentation in the mattress where your body had been and a puffed up area around the indentation where the mattress rose. Once you get up, the mattress takes a little time before it relaxes back to its original shape. Even the strongest materials, including the Earth's crust, move or deform when enough pressure is applied. So when ice by the megaton settled on parts of the Earth for several thousand years, the ice bore down on the land beneath it, and the land rose up beyond the ice's perimeter, just like the mattress did when you lay down and then got up. That's what happened over large portions of the northern hemisphere during the last ice age, when ice covered the Midwest and Northeast United States, as well as much of Canada. Even though the ice retreated long ago, North America is still rising where the massive layers of ice pushed it down. The U.S. East Coast and Great Lakes regions, once on the bulging edges or forebulge of these ancient ice layers, are still slowly sinking from forebulge collapse or subsidence. Here's Matt giving us a brief introduction to the project.
We are out here at Poplar Island in the Chesapeake Bay, and we are trying to understand how fish use man-made marsh habitat. Poplar Island is a really interesting spot, so this is a case of trying to kill two birds with one stone. So the Port of Baltimore and Maryland Department of Transportation need to keep the channel open that leads into Baltimore Harbor, and it keeps filling in with sediment. So they have to dredge it out, and they got to put that dredged sediment somewhere. So people have been experimenting with this for a while now, but it's kind of reached a pinnacle at Poplar Island, where they're taking that dredged material and constructing marshes that to the naked eye look just like a marsh anywhere else in Chesapeake Bay. You've got low marsh and high marsh with Spartina and other marsh plants that should be here. You've got, you can probably hear it in the background, there's a bunch of seabirds that are flying all over the place and nesting here. There's an osprey I can see here off to my left. And so what we're trying to do is understand how the fish may be using these different types of marsh habitat. And my colleagues are yelling at me, so I'm going to go answer them.
As we have already learned, the restoration project is a partnership between the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Maryland Department of Transportation, Maryland Port Administration. At over 7 miles in length and over a mile wide, the project is a fairly massive undertaking. Here's Matt explaining how they build the marshes.
All right, let's talk about these man-made marshes. So the way that the Army Corps and the state partners at Maryland do this is they start with a giant ring of boulders. that's maybe surrounding an area the size of a few football fields. And then they fill that in. They raise that up. That boulder ring goes up above sea level, you know, maybe 10, 15 feet. And then they fill that in with all this dredge spoil as they're trying to clear out the shipping lane into Baltimore. It takes years, right? They fill it up with all this mud. It takes years for the stuff to kind of settle out and let all the water drain out of it. And once it's at the right thickness and height, they shape it. And they go in and they make all these little creeks that kind of help the water flow in and out on the tide. They push some of it up into little islands that birds like to use. You can probably hear some of them in the background. And all these creeks have sort of different characteristics. Some are long and skinny, some are short and fat, some turn a lot, some are really straight. And the question is, how do those different shapes serve as fish habitat? Are there certain shapes or sizes or configurations of the marsh habitat that the fish prefer? And that is what we are trying to answer. That's the question, that's the objective of our study. There's people out here studying terrapins, studying birds, studying juvenile fish. We are studying larger fish, things that people like to catch or have a commercial importance, things like rockfish or white perch, things like American eels. They use eels for actually striped bass fishing.
The specific goal of Matt's project is to try and determine which restored habitats the various wildlife most prefer, particularly the fish. Beginning in May 2023, they began attaching coded transmitters to dozens of fish and other aquatic organisms, and using an array of automated data loggers, they'll track their locations over the next 2 years. Among the most important species being tracked are striped bass, white perch, gizzard shad, red drum, cow-nose rays, croaker, American eel, and the diamondback terrapin. Striped bass are of particular interest as they support a significant recreational and commercial fishery in the Chesapeake Bay. The study is expected to demonstrate which aspects of the engineered and restored habitats, such as creek size, shape, and culvert type, are most used by fish and other wetland species, which will increase the effectiveness of restoration efforts. Here's Matt explaining how they accomplish this.
So, how are we keeping track of which marsh cells and which ways that they have designed the marsh creeks? How do we keep track of how the fish like different ones? And we're using something called animal tracking with telemetry. So the way this works is we put a coded transmitter inside a fish. So we actually do a little surgery. It takes about a minute or two. Catch the fish with the hook and line usually, or in a trap or in a net. Make sure it's in good, healthy condition. We make a little incision in the belly of the fish, and we put this coated transmitter inside the fish and then sew it up. Usually just one stitch does the job. So that transmitter pings out a number that says, I am fish number whatever it is, 5678. And it pings that code out every minute or two. And what we've done is install an array of acoustic listening devices throughout the marsh creeks. So if a fish swims by and it pings out its number, I'm fish 5678, then the recording devices tell us where and when that fish is in that particular spot. So we have all of these marsh creeks wired up with these recording devices. We've tagged a bunch of fish. Oh, I gotta take a moment here because there is a construction vehicle driving by that is making a bunch of noise. This is an active construction site, so dump trucks, giant bulldozers, loaders are constantly driving around, moving marsh material, moving sand and mud from one place to another. Okay, so we've got all these fish moving around, and we're keeping track of where they go, and we can tell things like how often they visit a certain cell, which parts of the cell they prefer. Do they move from one place to another in different seasons or even day versus night? All of those are types of things that we hope to find out at the end of this process. The objective is to figure out which aspects of these man-made marshes these large fish prefer to use. And the idea being, hopefully, with that information, the Army Corps and Maryland Department of Transportation can be better informed about how they want to do this kind of project in the future.
Not only is the project providing a location to deposit dredge spoil and restore lost habitat for local wildlife, the project has other benefits for the region.
One of the benefits of this island is that it provides shoreline protection for the communities that are along the eastern shore that face this part of the bay. Places like Tillman Island and Knapp's Narrows, those are going to get much less wave energy because this island has been put here. There's a couple of little islands here, Coach's Island and Jefferson Island, that were slowly disappearing under the waves of the bay as sea level rises and land subsides.
With the huge budgets projects like these require, many in the public very reasonably ask why. Why do we care so much about some disappearing islands in the Chesapeake Bay? Islands most taxpayers in the region will never see, much less benefit from directly. Matt explains why we should care.
So why do we keep talking about the marsh? Why do we care so much about the marsh? So this island is doing a few things, right? It provides a place to put the dredge spoil. So that's one benefit of it. This island is providing shoreline protection for Tillman Island by breaking the energy of waves as they come ashore, reducing the land erosion where everybody lives. And then it also provides habitat, right? Not only for the birds, but for the fish. And it's this meadow of marsh grass. Why do we care about the marsh so much? The marsh is basically the giant gas tank or fuel tank that runs the ecosystem of the bay for a large part. All that grass is basically converting energy from the sun into things that a lot of little critters can eat. All the snails, all the crabs, all the isopods, all that stuff is feeding on the base of the food chain in the marsh grass. Then all those little critters feed small fish that in turn feed larger crabs, that in turn feed larger fish. So all of a sudden, with this big fuel tank that is the marsh, we have the base of the food chain that is what people care about and think about when they think about Chesapeake Bay. Blue crabs, stripers, things like that. So that's why we care about the marsh.
Lastly, Matt explained some of the challenges and rewards of working on an island 2 miles offshore with limited facilities and its own unique set of complicating factors.
One of the things I find challenging about projects like this is also actually the most fun, and that is figuring out how to catch a diversity of local fish species in places that usually I've never been fishing and haven't worked. But you got to catch them making sure that the fish are in really good physical condition. So when we tag them, they survive and they give us good movement data just like any other healthy fish in the ecosystem would. So we always start this process by asking local fishermen about best fishing techniques for different species. Sometimes it's traps or nets. Sometimes it's, you know, rod and reel, hook and line with a particular lure or bait. And that's really when the fun starts, because mainly it's a lot of fun trial and error to see what works best in the particular place where we work. So, for example, at Poplar, really anywhere, gizzard shad can only be caught in briefly set gill nets. Got to catch them fast and get them out of the net pretty quick so that they're in good condition and they don't get all tangled up in there. Eels, on the other hand, can really only be caught in eel pots, or big eels can be caught in hoop nets. In the case of white perch and red drum, those are susceptible to the nets, but you can get them in better condition by hook and line, by just rod and reel with certain types and colors of spinner lures. Same thing goes with the striped bass.
A major economic benefit of the project is its ability to continuously accept dredge spoil from the Port of Baltimore. Any disruption in the near constant maintenance and removal of dredge spoil that is required to keep the Port of Baltimore operational would result in significant adverse effects to both the local and national economy. The port handles approximately 30.8 million tons of commerce per year, contributes $1.9 billion in business to the state's economy, and generates 50,200 jobs, 16,500 of which are directly related to port activities. Revenue impact from the port represents one-tenth of Maryland's gross product, and the Port of Baltimore is also ranked number one in the U.S. for automobile exports. The Poplar Island restoration effort will continue to accept dredged material until 2029. Habitat restoration is expected to be completed by 2041 at a cost of approximately $1.4 billion. Upon completion, the restoration will result in 1,715 acres of developed wetland, upland, and open water embayment habitats. As Poplar Island continues its resurgence, engineers, scientists, and others from around the country will closely monitor its success. For more information about NOAA's work in the Chesapeake Bay, explore the links on the main landing page where you found this podcast. To learn more about NCOS's role in these efforts, or about all the other great coastal ocean science being conducted by NCOS, please visit our website at coastalscience.noaa.gov. Thank you for listening.